This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Crude oil prices jumped about $1.50 a barrel this morning as jittery markets reacted to the bloody attack in Khobar, Saudi Arabia, over the weekend. 22 people died after terrorists took over a high-rise building largely occupied by foreign workers. The attack is being interpreted as an indirect assault on the oil industry in Saudi Arabia, and both foreign companies and their employees are increasingly concerned about how safe it is to live and work in the kingdom. And many worry that the next target could be critical nodes in the vast Saudi oil infrastructure, processing plants, pipelines, pumping stations, or export terminals. Later in the program, we'll take a look at the makeup of the newly selected interim government in Iraq. But first, we'll talk about the security of Saudi Arabia's oil industry. If you have questions about that or about why this single oil producer is so important to the global economy, give us a call. We'd also like to hear from those of you who've worked in Saudi Arabia or who have friends or family there. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And first we turn to Samia Nahul, who went to Khobar to report on what happened there over the weekend. Ms. Nahul is a reporter for Reuters and joins us now from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
What have you been able to piece together about what happened this weekend? How did it start?
It started very early on Saturday morning with four militants storming the Al Khobar Petroleum Center, which is an oil office there. They stormed the gates, they killed the guards, and they started shooting at employees. Then they went very nearby to the Arab Petroleum Investment Corporation, and this is very near this office, and they continued their shooting spree in there, and they killed a British project manager who was arriving in his car to start work early in the morning, and they kept on shooting, but they dragged his body. They tow it to their car, and they dragged his body into the street. Basically, they drove like 2 kilometers, dumped him on a bridge, and then tried to storm a compound, Western compound, but they couldn't get through the gates. And they continued to the main and very upmarket compound where many Western families and all workers live. And this is where the biggest drama happened for 24 hours. They went inside and started arresting people, killing whoever they see as Westerner. Mm-hmm. And basically they're trying to find from residents there who was a Christian and who was Muslim. And if they were Muslim, they would let them go. And if they were Christian, they wanted to shoot them. It happened for many hours that they were looking from one villa to another to find the Westerners. And they ended up at a big hotel there in the compound where many old workers and many Westerners, Western businessmen come and work, and this is where they took the hostages. And the whole drama lasted for like 24 hours until Saudi special units and commando units came by helicopter and jumped from on the roof of the building and tried to rescue the hostages. But then it was already a drama and scandal because they had killed nine of the hostages, and there were many others who were shot dead before, 14 at least.
Mm-hmm. So how many of these victims turned out to be foreigners, and how many, you say they were discriminating between Christians and Muslims, how many turned out to be Muslims?
No, they didn't kill the Muslim because when they found out that they were Muslim, they were telling them, we don't want to kill Muslims. We're just looking for infidels and Christians and crusaders. So please take us to the villas where the Westerners are. This is according to accounts of people who lived there, and they were Muslims, but they were working in these, you know, with oil companies. They killed many Indians. Basically, eight Indians were shot dead, and they killed an Italian cook, a Swede cook. They killed an American and a Briton. And basically, there were many Asians, you know, Filipinos and Sri Lankans also were killed.
Mm. Now, you said four people were involved in this attack. We're told three of them escaped.
Yes, right. Three of them escaped. There are reports that maybe there were seven, but nobody could really confirm it. You know, looking at the scale of the operation, many people would tend to believe that there were probably seven. The three escaped. It was something that probably the security authorities could have stopped them. But according to what officials said, they had to choose because these people, the hostage takers, have threatened to blow themselves up with the hostages if they were not let free. So security officials said they had to weigh it down. Either they have 41 hostages killed in addition to the 9, or you know, a bloodbath, or to let them free and to catch them somewhere else outside. We know that they interviewed the hostages afterward, and they were trying to get from them description and showing them some photos to, you know, to identify the people they had on their wanted list. So the hunt for them continues, and it's still going on. We know yesterday they sealed off two areas where they believed residents told them that they suspected militants, or these militants have passed through the area, and tried once they stole a car of a resident, and once they thought that they went into a mosque. So they've been hunting down for them, basically.
Has anyone or any group taken responsibility for this attack?
Yes, Al-Qaeda immediately took responsibility. It is its leader here in Saudi Arabia, Abdul Aziz Al-Mukarrem. Immediately after the end of the operation, there was a statement on the website in which he was gloating that he attacked oil companies and Americans, and that you know, he will continue to the battle against the Al Saud family, which he called them the apostates and the infidels and the allies of, you know, with the enemies of God, which is, you know, America, which this is what they refer to.
Mm-hmm. What's been the effect on foreign workers in Saudi Arabia and foreign companies as well?
Yeah, it is, you know, the first day, as people describe it, was shock and grief and, you know, disbelief to what happened. And there is a bit of anger that the security, they saw that security wasn't enough at this compound to protect people. So they're demanding from their companies or from the compound to increase and, you know, to heighten the security measures. There are many people considering leaving, not the employees themselves, but they want to send their dependents abroad. This is what the companies also have decided.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a state of fear, basically, that you know, this attack has spark among all the Western community, and even the Indians were saying now, you know, they don't differentiate between Westerners and, you know, Asian. They killed us, you know, and, you know, they say that, you know, they want to kill Americans, but they killed more Indians than Americans. So everybody is frightened, Asians, you know, Christians, Christian Arabs, and Westerners.
Was this story heavily covered in the Saudi media?
Yes, they did. They did cover it. You know, they showed footage, but, you know, the statement from the Interior Ministry didn't come very quick. They took their time to give the account of what happened.
Okay, thank you very much. And by the way, we're hearing reports today of another shootout with militants, this one in another part of the country, on the western side of the country, in Taif.
Yes. They are, you know, what we understand is that they're chasing wanted militants. The security officials are not connecting these militants to the other militants. But, you know, the search for militants, every week there are clashes with militants. Every week they're trying to arrest more militants. They're a long list and in every part of the country. So, you know, it is a very, you know, the area is very far from the Khobar. But they are wanted, and they are wanted for they are probably militants on the run.
Okay, thank you very much, and we appreciate it.
Thank you.
Samia Nahul is a reporter for Reuters. She joined us from her hotel in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. And with us now to talk about the terrorist threat within the Saudi kingdom is Robert Jordan. He was appointed ambassador to Saudi Arabia and shortly after the September the 11th attacks and served until last October. He's currently a senior partner with Baker Botts LLP, a Dallas law firm, and he joins us from his office there. And Ambassador, good to have you on the program.
Good afternoon.
What does this weekend's attack tell us about the current terrorist environment in Saudi Arabia, do you think?
Well, it tells us a couple of things. First, I think this is a shift in tactics by the terrorists. You may recall, beginning with the suicide bombings at the housing compounds last May, we saw use of massive explosive devices, attempts to penetrate into the interior of these housing compounds and indiscriminately attacking anyone who lived there. And even though mostly Westerners lived in these compounds, we then saw later in November attacks at an Arab and Muslim-inhabited compound, and this past April, an attack actually on a Saudi police building.
Mm-hmm.
This time they're shifting, and they're becoming much more targeted, and in some ways it creates a greater problem both for the Saudi government and also for Western business people who are expatriates living in the kingdom. It shows that they are the specific targets now, and it's a much more difficult kind of terrorist attack to resist. So that's the first thing it shows. The other thing it shows, I think, is that the Saudi aggressiveness since last May 12th in attacking these militants is sort of like kicking over an anthill. And we have these ants now on the run. They are very lethal at the moment, and I think we can expect a continued period of conflict and violence as they continue to be attacked and sought out by the Saudi security forces.
This is also Khobar is in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, which is the heart of the Saudi oil industry. There's a pipeline that runs from there to a port on the Red Sea called Yanbu. Just earlier this month, or excuse me, I think it was on May 1st, there was an attack on expatriate foreign workers there. And again, the body of one of them, in this case an American, was dragged behind the a car through the streets of Yanbu in this attack. Your successor as ambassador in Riyadh visited with some people, Americans there, and said maybe you ought to think about getting out.
Well, that's right. The embassy has made it clear that Americans who don't absolutely have to remain in the kingdom ought to leave, and that's, I think, at this stage, very good advice. Clearly, the terrorists are focusing on the oil industry right now, both, I think, for the purpose of harming the Saudi oil industry, as well as harming the world economy by keeping the price of oil artificially high due to the premium that is assessed because of the terrorist threat.
If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Mary's on the line with us from Davis, California.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Yeah, well, I would like to speak as someone who lived there in Saudi Arabia before the first Gulf War. My husband and I had always just joked that how could there ever be problems in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia? The people are very non-aggressive, easygoing, peaceful. We couldn't imagine there's such a peaceful people like this. But then after the Gulf War, when we decided to go back and try it again, the tension was just extreme. We couldn't imagine it was the same place, and everybody said it'll never be the same place. And we said, why? And they said, because the Americans are never going to leave. And people laughed. They said, no, they're only here for a short time. And so there was the tension between those who said, no, they'll never leave, just wait, and others who said, yes, they'll leave, don't worry, just wait. And now it seems that the bind, the double bind, maybe the country of Saudi Arabia, you can tell me what you think, could be that to get rid of the problem, they have to tell the military American to leave, yet if they don't dare to ask them to leave at this point, on the other hand, because it seems that the military is very much there to shore up the government. And I just wonder, please, can you anyone answer me? What is the military, American military in Saudi Arabia right now? When I talk to people, nobody even knows we have anyone there still.
Ambassador Jordan, we just have a few seconds left in this segment, but my understanding is the great bulk of the American military forces left Saudi Arabia after the invasion of Iraq.
That's exactly right. We completed our mission, and so we pulled out several thousand troops right after that. There are only a small number of Americans left there, and they're there for the purpose only of training the Saudi military. They're not there to provide security to the kingdom.
Mm. Okay, well, that helps to hear.
Mary, thanks very much for the call.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. We'll continue talking about the security situation in Saudi Arabia and the safety for American and other foreign workers in that country when we come back from a short break. If you'd like to join us again, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan. We're talking about the vulnerability of the Saudi oil infrastructure, the safety of the industry there, including, of course, the foreign workers, many of them American, who work in Saudi Arabia. Our guest is Robert Jordan, until last October, the U.S. ambassador in Riyadh. And if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, totn@npr.org. Ambassador Jordan, how dependent is the Saudi oil business on foreign workers, including Americans?
Well, I think you have to characterize it as a distinction between Western workers and others. There are only about 100,000 Westerners in the kingdom, of which about 25,000 are Americans. Certainly not all of them work in the oil industry. The Saudi oil industry over the last 5 years has increased its use of local Saudis to a great degree, and so they are less dependent than they used to be. There are still, though, a large number of technical people from the West, including America, and they're very important to the Saudi oil industry. I don't think, though, that if there were a significant departure of these Westerners, the Saudi oil industry would crash to a halt. In fact, I think they would likely be able to continue their production objectives. But in terms of long-term planning, technical expertise, they would lose a great deal of that if the Westerners were to leave.
Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Kay, who's with us from Miami.
Yeah, hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Neil. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just have a few comments and see what the ambassador would have to say in terms of the Saudi government's way of doing business with the rest of the world, Christians and non-Christians. Until recently, we've been listening to their rhetoric in their mosques, anti-Americanism and all that, and they've been allowing such things to escalate, and we've gotten to this point. And how is the Saudi government now looking at issues for gross human rights violations and other issues? And I'll take off my comments off the air.
Thanks for the call, Kay. Ambassador?
Yeah, this is a very important question. I was concerned during my 2 years in Saudi Arabia that the issue of human rights was one that we needed to have a more frank dialogue about. The Saudis have, I think, begun to understand that they have to do more about freedom, religious freedom, human rights, and women's rights. So they have methodically gone about re-educating or, in some cases, firing a number of the imams in the mosques who were preaching extremism, hatred, and intolerance. They have a long way to go, though, and I continue to receive translations of mosque sermons that are pretty outrageous in terms of their content. They've also worked on retooling their classroom textbooks so that they don't have the same degree of anti-Semitism, anti-Western hatred that they have in the past. But these seeds have been planted in the minds and hearts of quite a number of young Saudis, and it's going to take a generation to flush this kind of hatred out of the system, even once it becomes stabilized. So I think this is an area that is a source of continuing concern to us. The Saudis realize they've got a problem. It's just a matter of how aggressively they are able to deal with it, where they don't literally control the absolute content. They have to walk a tightrope in many ways with their own religious establishment, because that establishment is very powerful.
Some would say, as I'm sure you know, Mr. Ambassador, that the United States has helped contribute to this by helping to support what some would regard as a corrupt government in Saudi Arabia, the royal family, and has not worked for democratic reforms.
Well, I think there is a grain of truth in that, or more than a grain. I think we've only in the last couple of years begun to have discussions with the Saudis about democratic reform, about public participation and transparency. I'm glad that we have done this. It's overdue. In the meantime, though, we have to bear in mind that if we withdrew support and allow this government to come crashing down, the government that would replace it would look a whole lot more like the Taliban than it would a Jeffersonian democracy.
One more caller. This is Mark, who's with us from Oakland, California.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, my question is this. You know, given close long-term connections between the Saudi royal family and the Bush family, I think it's possible to view cynically the decision a couple weeks ago by Saudi Arabia to increase production and lower oil barrel prices by a dollar. in order to boost President Bush's political standings here in the U.S. I'm curious whether the terrorists have claimed this as part of their motivation.
No, the terrorists have not claimed this. It's such an outlandish theory that not even the terrorists would try to make that point. It's been clear that the Saudis have tried to stabilize oil prices regardless of what administration is currently in power, and that's really what they're doing now. Frankly, I think they and OPEC misestimated the increased demand this spring that we've seen, particularly from China and India. And this has led to some of these shortages. But the fact of the matter is our refinery industry is about maximum capacity right now anyway. But there is really no grain of truth at all to this notion that there's some conspiracy between the administration and the Saudis to lower oil prices. The Saudis will kill the goose that laid the golden egg if they don't moderate prices, because it will lead to the kinds of conservation measures, the kinds of alternate production that the Saudis really don't want to see. They want a world that is dependent upon oil, and it's not to their long-term interest to keep the prices this high.
Mark, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ambassador Jordan, we appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Robert Jordan joined us from his office at Baker Botts LLP in Dallas, and again, we thank him for his time. With us now to discuss the vulnerability of the Saudi Arabian oil infrastructure, again, that's what many fear could be the target of the next attack, is Kevin Rosser. Mr. Rosser is an analyst for Control Risk Group, an international risk consultancy firm. He's with us from his office in London, and it's good of you to be with us tonight.
Thank you.
What did this weekend's attack tell us about the security of Saudi oil? This is not a direct attack on the infrastructure, but on the workers.
Well, this was very much an attack on foreign workers in the oil industry rather than the industry itself. Oil production continued in Saudi Arabia unaffected. The attacks themselves took place fairly far away from where all of that equipment is actually located. I think what we're seeing in Saudi Arabia is since the terrorist attacks of last year that triggered a nationwide crackdown on Islamic militants, is that the crackdown now is beginning to have some effect in terms of the number of people who've been arrested, the amount of weapons and explosives that have been recovered, and the way extremists have had to shift tactics in response to this. So what we've seen over the last year are attacks of decreasing sophistication, more and more resort to unsophisticated tactics like gun attacks or the shooting spree that we saw in Al Khobar over the weekend or before that in the city of Yanbu. Those unsophisticated tactics have been no less successful, but in terms of the oil industry and the integrity of the physical infrastructure and the security of supply to markets, that's all been unaffected. And if there is a silver lining to all of this, I think it shows that, in fact, the infrastructure is well protected enough that Saudi extremists are not trying to target it. It's a hard target now in the way that embassies and military bases are, and so that's why they've turned their attention to soft targets.
Yet some parts of the oil industry, these are enormous facilities with many, many workers, some of whom may or may not be sympathetic with some of these Islamic militants. There are pipelines that run for hundreds of miles across the country. Clearly, you can't guard it all.
No, you can't guard it all, and nobody would try to. There are thousands of miles of pipeline. The good news is that attacks on pipelines are generally pretty easy to repair. If someone shoots a couple of holes in it, you can patch it up. If someone blows up a length of line, you can replace it easily. The pieces of infrastructure that are really important are the bottlenecks. These would be things like pumping stations, big processing units, refineries, export terminals. These are the really critical nodes of the industry, and this is where most of the security attention goes. And there has been a great deal of effort in Saudi Arabia to try and tighten up the security around these facilities, and that includes both physical measures, sort of walls, fortifications, to things that are a bit more high-tech, motion sensors, aerial surveillance, anti-aircraft, in addition to lots of extra military and National Guardsmen around these sites. So these sites are now much more secure than they were even as recently as a year ago. And the Saudis have done that because they know that a serious attack, a successful attack on that infrastructure would prompt an enormous crisis of confidence in markets. And the last thing that they want, the last thing that's in their long-term interest is a spike in prices that would be caused by that.
How likely is it that there could be a coordinated 9/11 type attack on several of these nodes at once? And obviously, as you suggested, maybe up to a year or 2.5 years ago, such things were unthinkable. So was an attack on New York and Washington.
Well, absolutely. It's not impossible, of course, but it's not the most plausible scenario. As far as we know, have been really only two major terrorist attempts to target oil infrastructure in the Middle East over the last couple of years. One was a plot against the Saudi export terminal at Ras Tanura on the Gulf Coast. It's a very large facility.
I think it's the biggest one in the world.
It is. That's correct. It's about 4.5 plus million barrels a day export capacity. And the and that attempted attack was disrupted by the Saudis, apparently acting on information from the U.S. It happened sometime in the middle of 2001. We don't know what the nature of it was, but that plot was disrupted. There was a successful attempt to target shipping in October of 2002 off the coast of Yemen, when you'll remember the French supertanker was hit by a bomb that someone had put in a small dinghy that sailed up and detonated next to the hull. It didn't sink the ship, but it contributed to this speculation about the safety of the infrastructure in the Middle East. But in general, there haven't been very many attacks. Of course, someone who managed to hijack an airplane, for example, or who managed to carry out a very large, coordinated, multiple strike attack could do some damage, but it has to be said, you know, that the Saudis are beginning to make an impact now with their crackdown. They've tightened up things like aviation security. There are aerial surveillance measures in place and anti-aircraft. So the industry is looking a lot more resilient than it was a couple of years ago.
Let's take a call. Andy joins us from Palo Alto, California.
Yeah, hi. I had a question in regards to why the troops of Saudi Arabia. I wasn't really clear about how many troops we had in Saudi Arabia, but your guest said that now we have very few. So I'm assuming there were a lot of troops that were pulled out. And in light of the Iraq war, there was a comment that Paul Wolfowitz made in a Vanity Fair interview where he said that the reason for the war, one of the reasons was basically to find a place for American troops in the Middle East, and that weapons of mass destruction was just kind of a convenient reason. So in light of that, could you comment on, you know, why the troops are pulled out of Saudi Arabia and how it's connected to the Iraq war? Thanks.
Thank you very much for the call, Andy. Mr. Rosser?
Well, today in Saudi Arabia, there are very few American troops. There is a residual presence at some key military bases, but the U.S. Announced last year that it was going to be pulling all of its troops out of Saudi Arabia. Some of them have redeployed to other countries, places like Kuwait, Qatar, the UAE, in a low-profile way. But there are now very few American troops left in Saudi Arabia.
Weren't most of them associated with the effort to fly patrols over southern Iraq to guard the no-fly zone, as it was called?
That's correct. There were quite a few working on the operation to patrol the no-fly zone over Iraq. And after the fall of Saddam Hussein and the lifting of no-fly zones, their presence was no longer necessary. The U.S. And the Saudis had been very concerned for some time that they were becoming a lightning rod for people like Osama bin Laden. And it was seen as the right thing to do to withdraw that presence entirely. So there are still a few people on the ground, but it's really only a residual presence now.
We're speaking with Kevin Rosser of Control Risks Group International. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's take another call. This is Reshma, who's calling from Saratoga, California.
Yes, hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm actually Indian origin. I was born and raised in Saudi Arabia, and my question is regarding the Saudi situation currently. I was concerned in how is Al-Qaeda able to recruit these people to do these attacks? And my concern was towards the Saudi situation itself. Like, what is the percentage of poverty level amongst the younger Saudi generation? How often are they being able to get employment as compared to the expatriates? And what is the level of expatriate employment there currently? And what is the government doing regarding that? Because I was concerned about how is this younger generation who's hatred level, like I heard from the other callers, that has risen to the level that they're doing such atrocities against the expatriates.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, in terms of people who were recruited into Al-Qaeda, there are really two generations. One were Saudis, was the generation of Saudis who went to Afghanistan in the 1980s to fight against the Soviet Union. And those people came back and were pretty well reintegrated into Saudi society. The generation and that flow of people set up an infrastructure which continued to draw Saudis to Afghanistan. In the 1990s, during Afghanistan's civil war, a number of Saudis went over and received training in weapons and explosives and other paramilitary skills. They came back to Saudi Arabia in the late 1990s and were not able to reintegrate. The jobs weren't there. They weren't treated as heroes the way people who fought against the Soviets were. And it became much more difficult to bring those people back into the fold of the society. It's this generation which is really the core of Al-Qaeda in Saudi Arabia today. Of the five terrorist attacks that we've seen over the last year, four of them have involved people who have been well-known to the Saudis in advance, people who've been to places like Afghanistan or Chechnya and received that kind of training. And so they really are professional terrorists. And in that sense, the threat in Saudi Arabia is finite. Once these people are contained, that will do a lot to help diminish the threat. But there will always be newcomers coming in spurred on by the war in Iraq or the internal situation in Saudi Arabia, and that's a longer-term problem.
But briefly, in terms of Reshma's question, how much of this is resentment that many of the best-paying jobs go to foreigners?
Yes, that's...
That's true. I mean, there are about 6 million foreigners in Saudi Arabia, so it's about a fifth of the population. And the labor market in Saudi Arabia is basically divided. On the one hand, you have the labor market for the private sector, which is filled almost entirely by foreign workers. And then you have the labor market created by government spending. And in that sector, it's almost all Saudis. So the problem has been that as oil revenues have stagnated, because prices don't usually increase very much, and you can't usually increase the amount of oil that you're selling, the government has found it more and more difficult to spend at a time when population growth in Saudi Arabia has been running ahead of the economy. And so they're finding it more and more difficult.
Reshma, I'm going to have to thank you for the call and thank Kevin Rosser for his time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And when we come back from a break, more on oil markets and the new government in Iraq. It's NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This weekend's attack in Saudi Arabia startled the world oil market, and joining us now to talk about how that market has reacted is Phil Flynn, Vice President and Senior Oil Analyst at Aileron Trading, a future and options clearing firm. He's with us on the phone from Chicago, and good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil, for having me.
Stock market's been open for about 5 hours now. Oil trading's been going on all day. How's it reacting to the weekend attacks in Khobar?
Well, it appears that the stock market's able to take the shock a little bit better than the oil markets. The oil markets really rallied extraordinarily hard, closing up over $2.44 a barrel in crude oil, which is a pretty impressive move for just one day. But kind of an interesting side note, the Treasury bond market actually closed lower. Now, you would expect with that type of uncertainty in the world that we'd see some type of a flight to quality, but we didn't see that in the Treasury bonds, and we really didn't see it in the metals markets. You know, the major impact was directly at the heart of the source, and that was oil.
Mm-hmm. So not gold is what you're saying about metals.
No, gold actually closed a bit lower. So it appears that this was very much an oil-led rally, and that maybe the only market that didn't expect something to go wrong over the weekend was the oil market, and it did react pretty substantially.
Well, with that jump in prices, crude is now, well over $40 a barrel. How much of that do you estimate is the so-called terror tax?
Well, you know, I mean, that's a big debate. I mean, we did close at an all-time high price today at crude oil at $42.32. I think just based on what the market did today, I would say that at least the move today was obviously all because of what happened in Saudi Arabia. So you know it's at least $2, if not more like $4 to $5 per barrel. I think that instead of using the word terror premium or security premium, I think what I would use today is a vulnerability premium. I think the markets are starting to feel very vulnerable. The world's oil supply is at risk and obviously a target of Al-Qaeda.
OPEC representatives get together in Beirut on Thursday. It's a regularly scheduled meeting. What effect do you think this attack will have there?
I think it's going to have a positive effect on OPEC. In fact, it may even unify OPEC somewhat into raising production. I mean, if there were any questions that we needed to raise production within OPEC, I think Al-Qaeda attacking Saudi Arabia probably answered that question. I think, in a way, by attacking the Saudi oil fields, it was not only attacking Saudi Arabia, but it was attacking OPEC as a cartel. And I think that now maybe every member of OPEC realizes that they, too, are a target of Al-Qaeda and may actually try to thwart any rise in price because of this. Now, there is some question about how much OPEC can really do. I mean, right now they're pumping an awful lot of oil. The only excess capacity is in Saudi Arabia. You know, will they be able to stop this trend up in price? I think this gives OPEC a new reason to try to stop this price rise, and we'll probably see more oil production out of OPEC. You know, the question is, how much can they actually do?
Mm-hmm. Let's get a question from a caller. David is with us from Denver.
Hello, Neil.
Hi, David.
I'm a professor of international business at the University of Colorado at Denver. We teach our students that OPEC is a producers' alliance, or a group of suppliers who protect their own interests by tweaking the supply. The U.S. is said to have close political ties with Saudi Arabia. My question is, how do these close political ties affect the U.S. supply and price of our oil?
I would say that over the last few years, there's no doubt that within Saudi Arabia, their close ties to the United States has been a win-win for both sides at times. For example, during the last Persian Gulf War, the Saudis led the charge to raise oil production to try to keep prices under control. But obviously, it's been a love-hate relationship. There have been times when we believe that Saudi Arabia and other OPEC members should have raised production, especially earlier in the year, and they failed to do so. But obviously, there's this time when you know, that OPEC has to realize that if they kill the golden goose that feeds them, nobody wins. They learned that lesson in the 70s when they basically inspired the U.S. economy to get off some of its addiction from oil, and then it ended up hurting them. So I think they realize that they can't damage the world economies, but at the same time, they're also worried about their own economies and making money. So it is a love-hate relationship, and I think that balance of relationship may have become even closer because of what happened in Saudi Arabia this weekend.
Mm-hmm. Will our involvement in Iraq affect OPEC's market supply and our price for oil?
I think at some point it will. I mean, right now, Iraqi oil production fell from last month, but you know what? They were almost exporting as much oil as they did before the war. But let's face it, a democratic Iraq is one of the world's best hope for future oil supply. If Iraq becomes stable, they're sitting on the second known largest oil reserves in the world, and if investment is allowed to flourish in Iraq, you know, for the explosive demand in oil that we're going to see in the next 20 years, we're really counting on a stable Iraq. So I think at some point Iraq is going to be a major player. But I think in the past, OPEC has really worked to hold back Iraqi oil production. You know, the oil for food situation played into OPEC's hands because really the UN was doing the job for them. They didn't have to worry about Iraq oil production. They could worry about their own members in the cartel. In the future now, obviously with the demand situation changing, all the rules are being rewritten as we go.
David, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Phil Flynn, we appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Phil Flynn, Vice President and Senior Oil Analyst at Aileron Trading, and he joined us from his office in Chicago.